Potential, Not Pathology, embracing creative and resourceful approaches to psychotherapy with author and therapist, Dr. Paul J. Leslie.
Welcome to Potential, Not Pathology, where we offer information and inspiration for mental health therapists who are interested in learning and applying unique therapeutic techniques and concepts into their work. With a focus on the potential each client brings to his or her therapy session, this program examines ideas and tools which can assist your clients on their journey toward healing. In this episode, we are talking to Dr. Lynn Johnson. Lynn received his doctorate in counseling psychology, and in 1984, he opened the Brief Therapy Center in Utah, and it has become an internationally known center for research and training in solution-focused treatment. Now, he's a trained therapist in positive psychology and rapid treatment and coaching techniques from all over the world, and was instrumental in creating solution-focused counseling skills that have influenced thousands of shrinks. He's also applied solution-focused tools in his consulting work with various organizations, and he's written 4 books and over 30 articles pioneering the use of measurement tools and executive coaching, and his focus on outcome being achieved in the therapy room. In our discussion, which I just enjoyed so much, it's like catching up with an old friend on a front porch in a rocking chair. It's such a joy to talk with. We talk about kind of his background a little bit of how he was hanging out with Steve DeShazer and Milton Erickson, why he feels it's important that we're constantly measuring what we're doing and focusing on our alliance and the importance of outcomes. He's really stressed outcomes, but also being open to improvisation and trusting ourselves and our unconscious. He felt it's importantly to indirectly but also direct a session. So you're indirectly directing and getting people to be less rigid, not just the clients but also the therapist. And he uses this wonderful analogy about farmers and hunters, plus talking about some of his early supervision that he went through with quite a remarkable man. So I hope you enjoy this wonderful interview with Dr. Lynn Johnson. Dr. Lynn Johnson, welcome to Potential Not Pathology.
Well, Dr. Leslie, thank you for having me on.
I'm delighted. I know that you're very busy, and I know your time is valuable, so we appreciate it.
My time is valuable depending on what I'm doing. When I was, I remember when I took over my practice and the people in the offices, I'm in a condominium office complex. A lot of doctors, they own their own offices. Mm-hmm. And what happened is they ended up voting me in as president of the condominium association. And that meant I had to line up snowplow people in the winter and lawn people in the summer and so forth. And I thought, well, I'd give my kids the lawnmower job because it's a, you know, it's a fairly good income. And one day they were way behind. So I grabbed a lawnmower and started mowing the lawns with them. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that I might say, oh, my time is worth $100 or $150 an hour in my office. When right. I'm out blowing leaves and mowing and things like that, my time's worth maybe $20 an hour. And in fact, that in that case, it was worth $0 an hour because I just did it to help my kid out. People get this idea that they're valuable, intrinsically valuable. And I think, well, you know, we're valuable depending on what we're contributing to the world. And if you and I contribute to someone's mental health, that's like that old credit card advertisement. It's priceless.
Indeed.
And if we're not contributing, then what we're doing has little or no value.
Now, true.
The trouble with that is that it's not always clear whether we're helping or not.
Indeed, indeed.
So and way back in about 1993, 94, Mike Lambert created something called the OQ45, which is an outcome questionnaire with 45 items.
Yeah.
And I started using it. And I found it was very helpful because I could tell week by week whether I was getting better or worse with my this particular patient. So around that time, I also had a chance to stay with a fellow in Milwaukee named Steve DeShazer.
Yeah.
And I stayed at his house for a while, and I'd go to his clinic and watch what he was doing and so forth. And one night I was, after work, we went out to have a sausage of some kind. They're great big sausages they sell in Milwaukee. And my gosh, it's a whole dinner, right?
Yeah.
And we're talking. I said, there's something absolutely unique about your practice here. Steve wouldn't say anything unless you ask him a question. He just looked at me. Said, look, you do a lot of workshops. And that means sometimes you're on the road. And if a patient comes in that saw you last time, they don't see you necessarily. They see whoever is in the clinic at the time. Mm-hmm. They had this kind of weird clinic where people pretty much watched everybody else's work. You know, it wasn't a real crowded, busy clinic because you always had time to go watch what the last person had done. And I said, and he said, and he didn't say anything. And he said, well, the question I have is, the best predictor of outcome in therapy is the alliance, and yet you totally ignore the alliance. And so what do you make of that? So finally, I got him to say something. He said, "Well, you can't measure alliance, so I don't think it really exists."
Huh.
And I thought, you know, and so. What I did, Paul, is I went back and to Salt Lake and started, you know, doing some reading on alliance measures. And in a way, he was right. I mean, there was an alliance measure over at the University of California that they had developed there at the Langley Porter Institute, where I did my doctoral research. And basically, it consisted of having three psychiatrists watch your session from behind a mirror and then rate your alliance.
Huh.
Well, that's a real practical thing, right?
Yeah.
So you have three colleagues sitting around with nothing to do but watch you, right? I thought, well, this is ridiculous, you know. And I started looking at some of the paper and pencil items and they weren't very good either because they were 30 and 40 and 50 items long. Now, yeah. If you're going to do an alliance measure, it makes sense to measure it every time, right?
Right.
Because you might put your foot in your mouth one time and you might not even know it unless you ask the person, well, how did you think the session went?
Right.
So I created an alliance measure and I had 10 items on it. I had 8 items. And this social worker that was working at my office said, well, this isn't any good. Really? Why? Just got 8 items. Your point being, he said, 10 is a better number. People like the number 10. I said, okay, let's create 2 more items. We thought for a minute and we brainstormed hope and help. I felt the session was helpful, and I felt hope at the end of the session. Well, Paul, those 2 items turned out to predict outcomes at my clinic better than any of the other 8 items.
Huh.
So I learned two things from that. One is I did a better job if I constantly measured what I was doing. In my case, I was using the OQ45. Mm-hmm. It takes 3, 4, 5 minutes for the person to respond to it. So if they show up 5 minutes early, they've got plenty of time. Sitting on a clipboard on the counter, they pick it up, they do it. Takes me 2 minutes to score. And then at the end of the session, I can give them my alliance measure. Mm-hmm. And then I know whether I'm on track or not.
Yeah.
So my time is valuable depending on whether I'm accomplishing something. That's my time is valuable.
Well, since you brought that up, why do you feel there's a, I'm trying to think of a nice way to put this. There is a, for some people, a resistance to measuring, you know, what we're doing. I know some people may feel like, oh, it's restraining my in-the-moment creativity, but that's not the purpose of measuring as you're discussing. Why do you think some people are hesitant to go down that road?
Well, that's interesting. One reason that I found is that it's not how we were trained.
Yeah.
See, nobody trained me in grad school to do assessments at the end of every session. And so, you know, there's some kind of hesitancy for us to do things that in a way that we weren't trained. Now that shouldn't impede us at all, but I think it does. And the thing, I'm sometimes afraid that I've messed up and I don't want to hear about it, you know. I remember Milton Erickson telling a story about some guy that lost his wallet and he looked in every pocket but one.
Uh-huh.
He said, "Why don't you look in the last pocket? Oh man, if it isn't there, I'll just die." I never did understand most of the stories he told, but the point is, in that one, I did understand that we kind of don't want to talk about things and show and look at things and examine things sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some of that, but here's the thing. When there was a guy named Scott Miller that came to see me when he was a grad student, mm-hmm. and he wanted supervision, and he was in psychoanalysis at the time, and I knew his analyst. I thought his analyst was a lovely man, but so scatterbrained, I couldn't imagine how he could ever be a therapist, you know? Never. Well, he free associated all the time. You never know what was going to come out of his mouth. And he didn't either, you know. So it made for interesting seminars when I was a graduate student, but I could never sort of like, you know, never understood a single word he said.
Yeah.
So Scott came to see me, and he was in psychoanalysis, and he was seeing patients, and he wanted supervision. And I listened to some of his tapes, and I thought it was a pig's breakfast. I mean, it was just a mess. I couldn't see where he was going. He was kind of trying to do some kind of psychoanalytic treatment with these patients that he was seeing in a chemical dependency setting. And these alcoholics and drug addicts, they weren't good candidates for psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
So I got him doing outcome questionnaires, and I got him to do a session rating scale. And so when he was still a student, he was getting in the habit of asking people sort of before and after questions. And I thought that helped him a lot. I mean, I think it really has done him a lot of good over the years. So part of it is, you know, if you weren't trained that way, it takes a lot of effort to organize yourself and get clipboards with the measures and make sure everybody gets one when they come in.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really helpful. And so when we're doing the right kind of work and people, you know, people are showing us through their ratings that they're making good progress. Yeah, then we're making a good impact on the world, and our time is valuable.
Yeah. You know, I find that just asking, I remember years back, I just started asking at the end of most sessions is, well, what was this session like for you? And just, you know, not a questionnaire, but I just always wondered why other therapists didn't ask, you know, what was this like? You know, did you get anything out of this? And I found that most of my clients were, you know, they're happy to tell me what they liked, and sometimes even more happy to tell me what they didn't like, and that's good for me.
Well, yeah, it's vital. It's vital. Mm-hmm. I had a supervisor that was a Carl Rogers kind of guy, and he used to ask people, "What's it like to be you with me right now?" Mm-hmm. You know. What is your experience like as you and I sit together? What's your experience of me? How do you find me? How do you encounter me? And he would ask these kind of questions. And I thought, kind of gutsy.
Yeah. Indeed. Well, let me ask you, with the idea of continuing on with the idea of measurement and outcomes, over the years, I mean, you're known for a lot of your work with the solution focused and outcome brief therapy. With this focus on outcomes, how has that shaped how you've practiced over the last few years in particular?
Well, I had a guy come see me yesterday, and I hadn't seen him for a couple of years. He said, "I cheated on you." We laughed. He told me about a therapist he went to see, and he saw this therapist for 6, 7, 8 sessions. And he said, nothing was happening, and the therapist didn't have a clue. Well, come back next week, and we'll continue this. And he just quit going because he thought, why should I continue this? We're not getting anywhere.
Yeah.
So, focusing on the outcome, I'm saying to myself, what does Paul want from me today in the next 40 minutes or so? What does Paul want to achieve? And I ask you that, and I look for subtle things and little hints that you're maybe what you're not saying, but I'm trying to figure out. Mm-hmm. You ever hear Milton Erickson's definition of psychotherapy?
I'm sure I have, but if you know it, please share it.
That's I'm sure the right question, but you know how this kind of game works. You're supposed to say no, tell me. And I say, well, he would, you know, he liked it when his students would say, now Milton, what's psychotherapy? Psychotherapy is when two people sit in a room and talk till they figure out what the hell one of them wants.
By the way, that was a very spot-on Milton. You did it right.
Yeah, I know. The only thing I got from spending time with him is I could mimic him. But here's an interesting follow-up on that, which is there was a psychiatrist here in town that when she was a young resident, she happened to be a resident down in Phoenix, of all places. And she sought out Milton for therapy, and years later, she joined the Utah Society of Clinical Hypnosis and was active in our group that way. And one night I said to her, Susan, what was it like being in therapy with Milton? And she said, the thing she noticed is how he kept going over and over, what is it she wanted from being with him?
Yeah.
What is it she wanted? And he just kept returning to that.
Yes.
Now, what I've found, Paul, is there's a lot of people that I see. I don't know. They're a little bit like my wife. When we first got married, we got in a nice fight one time. And I was frustrated with her. And I said, well, what is it you want? And she got angry. She says, I'm not like you. I don't know what I want all the time. It takes me a long time to figure out what I want. Okay, well, why don't we suspend this fight? You get back to me. If I know what you want, then I can work with that. And so Erickson, I think, was convinced that a lot of the therapy is helping people figure out what they want.
Yeah.
So if I keep asking you, So, Paul, what is it you want right now from me as we, as you and I are talking? Mm-hmm. What is it that you'd like me to be doing? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times people say, oh, just listen to me. Okay, fine. And how does that help? Well, I'll feel better. Good. Okay. When you and I work together and you feel better, that means you're getting what you came for. Is that what I'm hearing? And then what I'll do is if I can do something surprising or throw them a curveball and I see that they smile or chuckle or laugh, I'll say, are you feeling better right now? How did we do that? What happened just then? I mean, your face lightened up and there's this kind of light in your eyes. And what went on? And what I'm doing is getting them to figure out how they contributed to make something good happen right at that moment.
Mm-hmm. So it's the focusing not on just the, in that example, the emotional state, but the for lack of a better term, the co-creation that the client was as much involved as the therapist rather than, look, I've done something as I'm the therapist, I've done something to you.
Mm. That's a nice way to put it, Paul.
Yeah. Okay.
I quite like that. Am I doing something to you, or are we sort of working together in some kind of improvisational thing?
Right.
I knew a therapist over in Denver who said the best thing that ever happened to him is he took a course on improv.
Yeah.
And he said it was incredible, you know. I mean, it was just, he said every therapist should learn improv.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Totally agree. Improv comedy specifically, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think a lot of it, the first time I ever met Milton Erickson, he showed me cartoons he had picked out of the, he'd cut out of the newspaper. You know, and he's laughing at these cartoons. And I thought, oh no, I got here too late. He's gone senile on me. I really had that thought for a minute. I wonder if he's gone senile. And then I figured that he was always operating on like several levels at once, mm-hmm. you know. And these cartoons actually illustrated some things he wanted us to take home as therapists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this kind of interaction, how do you, improvisational interaction, how would you do your measurement while you also give yourself the space to improvise?
Well, another really interesting question, you bet. Okay. Now, here's my meta strategy. See? People come in looking bad, and in my mind, I create a picture of them looking really light, happy, energized, lifted, mm-hmm. right? Right. And I just set that in my mind with a kind of a question. I'll be really curious to see what my unconscious comes up with to make that happen.
Hmm. So it's just that inner trust that you have in your own self to kind of have the outcome in your mind, but to kind of also release it to, you're not, you know, rigidly trying to control it happening. You're just, this is the goal, but I'm giving myself enough space and allowing, as you say, your unconscious mind to just create that roadmap.
You ever think about the difference between a farmer and a hunter?
No.
Well, a farmer collects seeds, stores them, plants them at the proper time, nurtures the ground, keeps it watered and protected from weeds, and then the crop comes up. The hunter goes out with the attitude, something will show up.
Hmm.
Now, I think therapists are farmers and hunters. You know, we plant the seed and so forth, but When I was a kid, I loved to watch my dad cut hay because every once in a while a rabbit would run out from the hay. And I thought that was really exciting. Or every once in a while, a pheasant would fly up as the cutter bar got close to the pheasant, it would spook and fly up, uh-huh. You know. And I just loved riding on a tractor with him and watching animals pop up from the alfalfa. You know, so there's the hunter side of therapy, which is we have this absolute confidence something will show up. I think having that confidence sharpens your eye. I think there's a lot of evidence that what we prime people to see, they will in fact see. That makes sense? In other words, if you ride around with a policeman, and I've done this, a policeman will see things that you don't see.
Yeah.
Because he's primed to see that. Well, for that matter, therapists see things that we are primed to see.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was out with four or five other couples one night. We were having a raucous conversation at a restaurant, and a woman we'll call Joan, it's not her name, down the table from me said, "Well, I'm afraid to talk around Lynn." And I leaned over and looked down the table and I said, "What do you say?" She said, "I'm afraid to talk around you." "Why?" "As you know, you're a psychologist. You'll analyze what I'm saying." "I said, no, I'm not." "Is what? What are you? Are you a psychiatrist?" "No, I'm not a psychiatrist." And she got frustrated. She says, "What do you do for a living?" I said, "Well, until 5 o'clock tonight, I was a psychologist. I'm not one now, and I won't be one until Monday at 9 a.m.
Yeah.
What I didn't say, Paul, is, and if you want me to analyze you, you have to pay me right. money. But you and I both know that revealed a great deal about her.
Yeah.
And from that interaction, I understood a lot of things. And years later, when certain things changed in her life, I saw it coming. I knew what was going to happen, you know. So on the one hand, let's just say that's an example of the hunter mentality. Something just popped mm-hmm. up here.
How does somebody who thinks they're only a farmer get themselves to think like a hunter?
That's a good question. Oh, I had a supervisor named Ernst Beyer. Ernst Beyer was a kind of a strategic therapist before there were strategic therapists.
Yes.
Ernst was an interesting guy. He had been taken captive at the Battle of the Bulge.
Hmm.
He was a native German fighting for the U.S.
Sure.
Army. So he quickly buried his dog tags, which identified him as Jewish. Claimed to be a good Lutheran who'd grown up in a German-speaking home in Persephone, New Jersey. He'd attended college in New Jersey, and he knew his way around, you know, after he escaped from Germany and came mm-hmm. to America. But there was this SS officer that suspected that he was one of these escaped Jews. That 1938, 1939, a lot of Jews escaped from Germany, and then they kind of slammed the door shut, and Ernst was maybe on the last boat out, you know, as a young man, and he got to America. And he got a four-year degree in chemistry in 2 years. He worked as a chemist, and World War II started, and he volunteered to be in the 10th Mountain Division because he was an expert skier. But they said, no, no, we're going to use you in intelligence, you know. You're a native speaker, German native speaker. We're going to put you in intelligence. So he went ashore on D-Day, fought his way through France. He ended up in Belgium in December of 1944. And, of course, we know what happened. So this SS officer suspected him, and he called him in to interview him. Now, they called this SS officer Dr. Death, because he'd generally find some excuse for having you shot. And Ernst was terrified, of course, and he walked in, and he looked around, and there were books on Goethe and Faust, you know. And Ernst had memorized Goethe. He was a secular Jew, and Goethe was his Bible. Mm. He had huge chunks of it memorized. I don't know if it was that he knew the entire poem from the beginning to the end. And so, and then he saw some Berliner Philharmonische records on the 78 RPM record player, see? And he had been to the Berlin Philharmonic. And he saw a painting on the wall. And he knew the painter. They had hired that painter to paint their family portrait. And he said something occurred to him. And he said to him, "You're a very well-educated man. It must be very lonely for you, a man like you, working in a place like this."
Yeah.
And then there was about a 7 or 8 hour interrogation, which ended up with the interrogator saying, "It would be safe if you were to return to your barracks now." And Ernst said something happened there that it was the hunter, see? Something changed. And he realized as he walked back to the barracks, he didn't want to be a chemist. He wanted to study why people do and how people can change things. Okay. So I'm having him listen to an audio tape of one of my sessions. And all of a sudden he said rather indignantly, "Why do you let her cry?" "Oh, what do you mean, let her cry?" She says, "Oh, she's crying. That's not good. You tell her. Look, you had to work, not to cry. Don't cry." "Gee, that sounds a little harsh." "No, no, she'll appreciate it, believe me." So, and I put it a little more gently, you know, but I essentially said, "Look, you know, your crying is distracting you from the hard work you need to do in here." 3 weeks later, she said, "All my friends say I'm getting better." "Really? Why is that?" "They say, Helen, you don't cry anymore." Ernst was always looking for those moments when he could make a big change in the way people looked at things. Yeah. He told me a story once about one of his patients that came to him. "Everyone said you were the best therapist in Salt Lake. I've come to see you for a long time. Nothing has changed. In fact, I just wanted to let you know, when we're done here today, I'm going to go out and kill myself." Ernst leaned forward, smiled, and said, "Well then, can I have your watch?" "How about your wallet? You won't be needing it, you know." And believe it or not, the patient started laughing.
Wow.
Now, that's not an intervention I recommend to anybody. In other words, it's kind of like you had to be there, right?
Yeah.
But Ernst had the hunter's mentality, which is something will show up, I will recognize it. There was one day in supervision. Well, after I finished, I did a year of supervision with him after I graduated, but then we just became friends and I would go to his apartment and we'd hang out and talk a little bit. And one day he would ask me my opinion about cases he was working on, which, you know, was a great honor, of course. But one day he said that he had seen this family and the father was very angry at the son, was verbally abusing him. So Ernst gets up out of his chair, walks across the room, and sticks out his right hand and says, "Sir, I must shake your hand." The man puts his hand out uncertainly. Ernst is shaking it, says, "Never have I found a man more devoted to helping his son than you. You must love him a lot." "Well, yes, I guess I do." Ernst walked back, sat down, looked at him, said, "Now your methods could use some improvement." You get this moment where everything changes. Now, on the other hand, Paul, just between you and me, most of the time I'm a farmer.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Sense? Oh, indeed. And it's okay to be a farmer, well, right?
Well, we're told that we eat too much meat and we ought to eat more vegetables, you know.
Oh, my.
So you want to cultivate the farmer's mentality of planting your seeds, nurturing them, things like that. And there are a lot of people that's what they truly need. They need a new seed planted, but then it has to be cultivated and nurtured and you know, kind of like protected from weeds and things like that. And then every once in a while, something shows up. And so if you were my student, which, you know, you're not, we're colleagues, but if you were my student, Paul, I would say, all right, the next time you come to see me, I want you to tell me about things that happened in the sessions that mm-hmm. you're going to do that surprised you. Now, what have I done? I've implanted an idea that surprise is important.
Right, right.
And once I get you finding surprises, and that's the thing. I mean, if you look for it, they'll be there. And once I get you looking for surprises, then.
So if we're looking for surprises or looking for anything, how much of our focus as the therapist is actually directing the session without us being aware that we're indirectly directing the session?
Yeah, that's now I do direct the session, you know, and I think Ernst kind of directed me towards that, you know. In other words, his notion was that the only reason he survived that encounter with Dr. Death was that he actively directed the session. The Dr. Death asked him a question, and instead of answering it directly, he quoted a quatrain from Faust. And he said, his interrogator stared at him for a moment and then quoted the next four lines back at him. Well, see, so there was this moment where Ernst changed the relationship from I'm going to make you admit you're a Jew to, oh, you're a very well educated person and you and I can have a high level conversation.
Yeah. So by what I'm hearing you say, Lynn, and you correct me if I'm off here, is it's almost like when our clients come in with their problem in the frame of a problem, we are also as therapists creating a frame of how to see their problem, and in some ways getting
I think you have to create a frame where the problem is seen as something like a blessing in disguise, uh-huh. or opportunity, or, you know, this guy that came back to see me after 2 years, he's been drinking heavily, and I said, "So what's the problem you're trying to solve by drinking every night?" And he was a little surprised. He said, "I don't have a purpose in life." And then we worked on purpose, and I found a way for him to find purpose.
So it's almost the linking of the way you saw this issue to the, so it's like this, I'm trying to put my words in the proper order here, but it's like, because you have this whole situation framed in a certain way, it's linked his behavior to your frame, which then links the behavior to an outcome that's a win-win for both therapist and client.
Yeah, I think we have to be careful to ask questions that we know how to answer in a way, you know. I mean, if I keep asking you, so Paul, what would you like to get out of our session today? So Paul, what's the main thing you'd like to take away from the session? That's very different than me saying, so Paul, what are the things that troubled you this week?
Yeah.
And I think the troubled you this week is a whirlpool.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Like, it's like one of my...
Scylla and Charybdis, you know. I don't remember if Scylla was the whirlpool or Charybdis was the whirlpool, but one of them's a rock and one's a whirlpool, you know. So it's like, you've heard that saying, between a rock and a hard place. Well, I think asking people to... Do you want
please.
Another story? One of the bad things about talking to an old geezer like me is I've got 1,000 stories. Here's a story. So this lady brings her husband in to see me. And she says, my therapist said you're really good with couples therapy. My husband and I have troubles. Okay. She sat down. She said, on your door, it says brief therapy center. That's true. She says, I don't believe in brief therapy. Well, okay. Tell me more. He says, well, I've been in therapy for 10 years. Now, I didn't say this, but I thought, well, yeah, it hasn't done you much good yet, has it, you know? You got to get your money back. And so I said, okay, tell me about the troubles you have. She says, well, it has a lot to do with my moods. When I'm in a bad mood, you know, things just really go downhill. I said, well, okay, as I see it, there's two ways we can go with that. One is we can help your husband not feel upset when you're in a bad mood. See, in other words, she's not in a bad mood by herself. He starts trying to correct her in some way or another, and his corrective maneuvers throw gas on the fire. She says, yeah, okay. Or we could help you with your moods. She says, well, let's do that. Okay, fine. And she says, so you're not always in bad moods. No, I go up and down all the time. Oh, that's fascinating. I like to hear about patterns like that. So there are times when you feel really good, and then there are times when you feel awful. And when you feel awful, you and your husband end up getting in fight. Yeah, you got it. Great, great, great. Now, can you describe for me when your feet, and I pause a minute, you know, a second or two for effect, right? Have to be kind of a ham to do this work. Now, when you're in a bad mood and you start to go into a good mood, what's going on there? How do you explain that? And she sort of sat back in her chair and stared at me. And she said, that's not what I expected you to ask. Okay. What do you expect me to ask? I expect you to ask about when I am in a good mood, what happens when I go into a bad mood. I said, I have no interest in that. You already know how to be in bad moods. We don't need to analyze that. What I'd like to do is figure out, when you're in a bad mood, how do you get yourself into a good mood? And she said, I've been in therapy 10 years. No one's ever asked me that question. But that's a question. See, I can figure out how to get people to do more of. It's hard to get people to do less of something. It's just, you know, it's hard for me to do less of things. I can do more of something more easily than I can do less of something. And so I figure if I can figure out this business of the up and down moods, I may be onto something. And she really liked that.
So overall...
A nice story.
Yeah. Overall, would you say, if you had to sum up your view on doing therapy that you've learned over the years you've done it is that you're still kind of bouncing back and forth between this farmers and hunters analogy you've used, or you feel like in order to be, you know, to have the outcomes and all this, you need to strictly be a hunter?
No, I think farmers, I really believe that a lot of what we do is seeding things and gently nurturing them. Mm-hmm. I believe that, you know, it says brief therapy on my door. I've seen people for 4, 5, 6 yeah. years at times. I've had a patient who say, what is about this brief therapy? I say, well, you know, all brief therapy means is not one session more than necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we'll just keep doing brief therapy until you are convinced that you don't need any more sessions.
Well, as our mutual friend Bill O'Hanlon says, he says, I always do brief therapy except when I don't.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, this is a profession that's good for people with real rigid notions about how mm-hmm. things need to be. I started out being pretty rigid, and I got beaten up a lot in trying to become a shrink. You know, I would have been a better attorney than a shrink. I really am convinced that I would have been much better. In fact, that's what I was going to be, and fate intervened, and I ended up being a shrink instead. But you know, it's a lot better being flexible and being able to shift quickly, and just so much easier in life. Talking to a friend of mine, and he was angry about the fact that in my state, all alcoholic beverages except beer are sold in state-sponsored liquor stores. And he said, the state shouldn't be in the business of selling liquor. Now, what I realized is that's none of my business. I shouldn't have an opinion one way or another because I don't patronize mm-hmm. liquor stores. And so it's not my business to have an opinion about it. I remember a colleague asked me about abductions by flying saucers because I'd seen a couple of guys that had been abducted by a flying saucer and hypnotized them and all that stuff. It was quite an interesting thing. And my friend was saying, well, what do you make of that? I said, I don't have an opinion about it. He says, I think it's a screen memory. Something else happened. I said, yeah, but you saw how terrified they were when they were reliving that abduction. Screen memories are never worse than the original experience. Mm-hmm. They're always easier. My friend says, wow, that's right, isn't it? Well, what is it then? I said, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. And yes. I don't need to know. It doesn't interest me that much. You know, I mean, I think, well, that was odd. I don't know what to make of that. But this thing about we have to always explain everything. So sometimes we farm, sometimes we plant our seeds and carefully nurture them. Every once in a while, something jumps up at us and we have a completely different hunter-like experience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Ernst Beyer says, Veded, can I have your watch? You know, my word. That changed that man's whole outlook on life in just this 1 minute. After that, he could never look at the world in quite the same way. And Ernst said that's what he was always shooting for, is that single trial learning. But I know people that saw him, and a lot of times he couldn't mm-hmm. get single trial learning, and he would see people for long periods of time.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
That makes sense? When I got ready to leave my week at working with Milton Erickson, I said, hypnotize me, make this wart on my finger go away. And Milton says, all right, I have to talk to you for 8 or 10 hours and bore the hell out of you before you go into hypnosis. And he turned to my friend that had gone with me down to Phoenix, and he said, Jay, how many times does Lynn have to tell himself to get rid of that wart? He said, well, conceivably just once. Yeah. If it doesn't go away then, well, then he'd have to tell himself again. All right. Until when? Well, I guess until it goes away. And Milton just turned and looked at me. 3 months later, the wart fell off. So that was kind of like a single trial learning, right? I mean, something happened there, and then 3 months later, you know, that embedded command mm-hmm. came to fruition. But frankly, there are probably people in Phoenix that saw Ernst for a long period of time, or saw Milton Erickson for a long period of time. So anyway, I was lucky to study with a couple of remarkable therapists, and I'm sure it helped me, but I'm not Ernst Speier and I'm not Milton Erickson.
Well, thank God we have Lynn Johnson.
And thank God we don't have very many of them.
You broke the mold, man. I'm telling you.
After that, you know, gosh, I don't want to go there again.
Well, as we come to a close, Lynn, would you please let people know the best way they can get in touch with you? Because I know in addition to your books and training and that you're also back doing therapy work again.
I'm doing some therapy. I don't want referrals very bad because I'm mm-hmm. as busy as I want to be. If people would like to contact me, they could email me at drlynjohnson.com. And again, drlynjohnson. So that's a good way to get a hold of me. It's the best way. I check my email at least once a week.
Yeah. And I'll put a link on the website to your webpage. And that way people can just click on that and go to and also check out your books, because you have some great books. And you're also doing some interviews yourself, aren't you, with other people?
I've done interviews from time to time for my mailing list. The people that have come to my workshops, a lot of them signed up to be on my mailing list. And so I interview people from time to time about that. That's always fun.
Thank you for listening to Potential Not Pathology with Dr. Paula J. Leslie. If you enjoyed the show, check out our website at potentialnotpathology.com, where you will find programs and articles showcasing unique and creative therapeutic applications.